The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is Sandy Martley, and you're listening to the Agile Uprising podcast.
Welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm your host, James Gifford, and we're bringing you an episode. It's our last episode from the San Diego series entitled Safe to Fail. And we thank you for your patience as we kind of gone through some experiments with these recording from live events. We've definitely failed in a number of ways. In this podcast, we started out with a major fail of me forgetting to start the recording when we did the intro in San Diego. So tonight, you're going to hear a podcast about making it safe to fail. We were joined by Erica Lenz, Andy Clef, Chris Merman, Claire Moss, and myself. So we really kind of get into talking about failures, and we appreciate your patience with us. We've learned a lot by doing these live casts, and recording in a tequila bar, probably not our best idea. So we look forward to producing some more live shows as we kind of get to the different conferences. And if we do find a podcast that isn't necessarily worth releasing to the larger audience, you can always check out the Agile Bootlegs thread on the Coalition site and find some interesting audio if you can handle listening to some slightly less good audio quality. Check it out. So we hope you enjoy this episode, and thanks for your listenership.
So I work at a custom software development shop called Asynchrony Labs. We have a small office in Denver of about, 45 people at this point, constantly reforming teams, working on various projects. But the thing that's so striking for me working there, I've been there a little less than a year, is that they really are living what we read about being okay with failure and vulnerability on teams. So it's marvelous to watch people just willing to sit there in a retrospective or even a turnaround in row and just say, hey, I just messed this up. Here's what I learned. Can someone help me fix this? And it's a palpable difference from other organizations I've worked in that we've all felt that have been giving lip service to the idea of failure, but it's not actually safe.
So wait, so what do you all think? So it's going to this lip service thing, right? What is that lip service felt like? What does it look like where it's not safe, right? Like, I think we've probably all experienced that, so.
I've come from environments where it wasn't even lip service. What the leadership put out there in slides and presentations and on posters on the wall was failure is not an option.
Mm-hmm.
And they meant it in the sense of big failure.
Right.
But I think it was interpreted as failure at any level, which would scare new team members. It would scare teams. The intention maybe was good. We cannot miss our deadline because there is huge dependencies across marketing. There's big spends in place. So failing to meet launch is a problem.
So, but
it puts a lot of pressure on people.
So that's a different kind of failure though, right? We're talking about, at least what works at Asynchrony is this idea that we can fail as we experiment and we're trying to solve problems. We still worry about deadlines because we're working with clients who we've contracted with.
That pay you money.
Yeah.
Well, that's what's interesting what Andy said, though. I do feel like he touched on something interesting is the failure you're speaking of, it's at a different level than the poster of you know, failure is not an option. Yeah. The context that Andy mentioned, though, I feel like has happened probably at more than one place, which is you say, like, whether it's either tongue-in-cheek or we say, hey, look, we want to take risks, you know, but we don't want to fail. We want to make our customers happy. All of these things, it gives the impression, it's hard for a newcomer to know the difference between, well, what does big failure and little failure like? Because sometimes there's a gray area and you're like, well, is this going to be considered okay? Because if it's not, I'm not going to open my mouth. Claire, you were going to say
something. I've got an idea.
Yes.
What if we say failure's not an option because we don't know how to make it small enough? What if we don't know how to slice failure into small enough bites that we can survive one?
I like that.
So when we say failure's not an option, it's because we don't have that habit of making things safe to fail.
Is that related to like the making small bets principle of
like Tell you me bet more about that.
Well, you bet small, you lose small. Like if you it goes back to slicing up the work, right? We wanna take small risks. We go off small lean experiments. We say I have a hypothesis and so on and so forth, and that could be within your iteration, it could be within your release, but if you're making a big bet of I think this product will make us all the money without, you know, that's a big bet that could make you lose big.
One way I've seen that reflected in work is when people decide they want to estimate things and they have a cap. If it gets beyond a certain point, we don't even think about working on it because we don't know enough. We feel that the failure is too likely.
Right.
And
anything
so
anything bigger than a 13 or 20 or 40,
whatever,
right.
Whatever estimate we want to put on it.
Yeah.
But we have a ceiling that says our risk threshold is like this, and we need to know more before we're willing to take something on.
So okay. You're putting containment, you're putting guardrails around the size of failure to make it safe.
When we know we have unknowns.
So, and the bigger the unknown, the bigger the risk.
So there's this risk management through how we deal with the flow of work by chopping it up into tiny little pieces. And then there's this other parallel thread around how we define failure in the culture. I think those are two separate things. They're related and they're tied together, but the management by dividing things into small vertical slices where you can, you know, take a little risk and experiment, spike on something to get more information about it, whatever you're doing in terms of breaking up the work into small pieces, that's almost mechanistic in terms of the risk management. Is that sufficient to make it safe?
So in this one context, we had this you know this highest
the
paid
hippo.
And person in the room came in, the old hippo, the hippo, and the hippo is like our customer service platform. We need the ability to print something. And I'm like, all right, great, but none of your other stakeholders have asked for this. But if you executive, if you're okay, we figure this is going to cost you about $300K, but what we'll do is we'll spend $50K on building basically a simple dialogue with a button that prints to your default printer. So you can test this. We'll validate this. And, you know, so then we marketed it, 6 weeks prior, the time that after we launched it. And sure enough, we got the data back, and literally 30 people clicked the link. 6 people actually clicked the print button out of 10,000 users. So it was... this was one of those things where we made it safe to fail. We made it safe for the actual investment, because instead of spending the $300,000 and just building it because some guy said, this is the most important thing and I'm right, we actually ran an experiment to validate it, making that change safe. And then once the executive actually saw that data, they were like, yeah, that was a really dumb idea. We should have probably listened to the people that we were talking about. And that was an instance where we used some ideas around using small vertical slices to deliver the simplest thing to make that investment safe for the people doing the work, but at the
same
time,
did you see any behavioral change that followed that?
After that, they were more willing to then go and actually test the experience and go, hey, let's, we showed them what a Kano analysis was, and
we actually had them starting to go out to the people and going, all right, well, what excites you about this list of ideas? What are the delighters? What are the detractors? Like, what don't you actually want to see in this product? And they started actually polling the service, the customer service people. And it was like, wait a minute, you're actually talking to people instead of just going with what the executive had. Now the teams at least have some safety net that they know that we're most likely not going to be derailed by just this VP that pops in.
And I think that's
a
perfect example of what Claire was saying about let's slice that failure up, right? Because $300,000, a $300,000 failure stings a whole lot less than a $50K failure, right?
Dropping $50K.
You said something interesting though that I want to touch on. So you said the manager, the head person, the hippo, the whatever, right? What I feel like you described a situation where management was able to be kind of coaxed into a lean experiment, right? So what I'm curious of, especially because you kind of work in that middle layer now, is like, why do managers suck at listening to their people when they want to do, when make smaller bets? Like, why do you think that's hard?
I mean, I think it's hard because there's a certain level of ego when you've risen to that level of kind of stature, or you're like the senior product development person. People are looking at you going, you've got all the answers. And so when you're coming into the room and you know, making that bet that says we're gonna make a bunch of money on this, and you fail, then it's a lot of egg on your face. And so them actually starting to realize, well, maybe I could have been wrong, and I would rather spend $50K to see if I'm actually wrong or right, and not waste time, because I still have a gigantic backlog of other stuff that needs delivered. And if I can reinvest that $300K, and that was the conversation. It was, look, we could fail fast. We can do this in 4 sprints, and you can fail, or we could spend 6 months on this, and because of that, we're going to potentially miss these items and these items.
Because you've taken failure out of the team room and moved it into the executive space and made it safe to fail, which is pretty powerful.
It sounds like you also have facilitated a conversation around how to view risk that maybe they didn't have before, because they were concerned about being able to deliver, but maybe not the implications for the business of putting that much effort into it.
Yeah. I'm curious, Giff, was that conversation difficult? Was it the first time you had it?
It was
the first time you had it?
We had it multiple times, and you know, we had to fail big on the failure before that was a time deposit product, and instead of doing a manual processing step and getting it out and meeting customer demands, we decided to do the longer pulse solution, which was a fully automated direct to booking to the accounting system. And what ended up happening was because we rushed it, the people were really, you know, running to meet that deadline of that, you know, we've got five 3-week sprints to deliver this entire ask, but we think we're going to smash in these extra requirements because somebody wanted them, and the teams worked a bunch of nights, a bunch of overtime, and then 3 trades in, we missed the Chinese freaking calendar. We missed the entire week that they have, like this weird week off thing, and we overcalculated some loans, and then the company lost somewhere around $500,000. And so now they had this gigantic egg in their face, and there was a whole big thing around the product manager and them not being able to get the teams the right stuff. And so because we had this huge failure, and it was a big sunk cost to the business, they were able to then go, all right, well, maybe we should probably take a different approach to this. But they literally had to fall flat on their face. It was like Charlie Brown coming up to kick
the
football.
Did people lose their jobs?
And Lucy pulled that sucker out. And they were...
Did people lose their jobs?
Nobody lost their jobs. But they definitely got dinged on
their performance. If you are a person who can see that coming, if you have information that's pertinent to that, is it something that you can share in an environment like that? Or is this let bad things happen so people can learn?
I called it out. I was the little boy who cried wolf.
And, you know, based on the schedule and what we could see, and it was, we don't care. You're wrong. And we'll get it done. And so, we would hope that leaders would see that and listen to a trusted advisor of somebody that's working with the teams day in, day out. But, you know, that isn't always the case to failure. So it's as a scrum master, as a product owner, as an agile coach, if you see these situations, it's your responsibility to call it out. But if they don't act upon it, it's, you know,
I want to question that effort because we've had a couple of conversations in the past couple of days about failure and the coach or the scrum master's response or anticipation. So let's take it out of the executive suite, bring it back to the team room. As a coach or a scrum master, if you see a team approaching a small scale, small F failure, what do you think our obligation is? Let it happen for learning? Step in to stop it, point it out, ask questions. I mean, these are all options available to us. What have we tried?
So we have rapid turnover in projects. So I've had a lot of opportunities already to see this happen on teams. And I think, based on my experience, I mean, we're expected to escalate if we see a problem and ask for help from any source we can get help from. But I think the most important piece of it is making sure that the team understands that there's a risk of failure. I don't know about everybody else's experience, but in my experience, teams often get kind of tunnel vision in the middle of the work. They're looking at the details of work, not the overarching flow of the project. And so they don't necessarily see that they're not gonna hit a target or that they're not communicating well with the client, even. And in a consulting environment, that's important. But so I spend a fair amount of energy reflecting things back to the team and then asking them, okay, so I see a risk here. What do you want to do with this? Because I don't want to disempower the team. I don't want to just go over their head and say, hey, this team's in trouble, but I haven't talked to them about it yet. I want them to have first dibs at trying to solve the problem. And then I'll help coach them through maybe what the incremental steps are to doing that. It's more of an ethical stance to me than anything. I think disempowering the team at that moment, that crucial moment, is a problem.
Yeah. One way that I have seen work, as an Agile team member, I have done a lot of different roles and activities that not all of my other team members have experienced. And when I advocate for a particular change, it's harder to internalize the reason for that if you haven't done the work. Mm. And so when you're making the case to a team member about a change that you believe needs to happen or a risk that you see, one approach that I have taken is to pair with that person and say, come and see. It's like, walk the floor, go to the Gemba, actually experience this, observe it for yourself, and see whether you come to the same conclusion. And that way they learn to see the different perspectives and to train their judgment and give other perspectives an opportunity.
Yeah, so what great. I feel like both of you all are describing is, so there's kind of different pieces of this. One is an awareness, right? So some awareness you're not going to get until you've done it before, right? I've not done consulting before, or I've not been a QA before, or I've not worked with a UX designer before and know all of the things that they need to do to get there. Like, you don't have that awareness. So I feel like a piece of failure is developing that awareness, and it's not just what do we do when it happens, but also what do we do while it's happening, right? So
yeah, and people need support through that, and I think so you need to make make creating that awareness okay. So you need to be good at feedback and reflecting things back to the team in whatever way you're doing. And you need to do that with respect and an understanding that sometimes there's a cognitive dissonance that happens for people when all of a sudden their perception, you're asking them to shift their perception. So you need to be patient and let them do that. And then I think you need to follow up and make sure that it landed and step into maybe more reflective listening or asking questions, getting them to talk to each other about what they're seeing, because your own perception of the potential failure is probably not complete as well.
And that can be within the team. It can be team to client, and it can also be team to executive in Gifford's case, right? So I had a boss once that said, hey, you're about to have a conversation where you need to put your empathy hat on. And it was like he would describe this physical act of putting the hat on of empathy, which, you know, I was in my 30s at the time, and I'm like, do we need to be using like the physical gesture of putting the hat on? But whatever. he was a great guy. Anyway.
Some people are experiential learners.
Yes, that's true. visual yes. Experiential learner. Yeah.
Kinesthetic.
Yeah, yeah.
For the listening audience, Claire is wearing a hat at this moment.
That's true.
My Devo hat, my energy dome is helping me channel my failure right now.
But the empathy hat that, wow, Andy just left in a cough. Is he? And now he's dancing to the cover band that
Shake
is playing off.
off
in the distance. But so this empathy hat he described, just it typified what you're describing of either giving feedback, either creating the right environment, which we talked about that, you know, in the pre-show chat, mm-hmm. Or when you're talking to your boss, right? So if you were to speak arrogantly to the hippo about like that's stupid, don't ever freaking do that, you know, or if you respond that way, then he's gonna come back over you even harder, right? But can you give that person, can you give that teammate that doesn't have that awareness of the role, Claire, right? Can you go, hey, like, I'm gonna walk with you and it's okay, like, I understand this is hard.
I think that the one way that has succeeded for me in inviting people into a new activity is to immediately reflect on that. I say, hey, we've completed this activity and I wanna see whether that was a useful pairing. Because if you've been exposed to something for the first time, it's really hard to absorb it. And I wouldn't expect them to have all the lessons apparent to them. But what I do hope is that it's been fruitful. And if that's something that is working, is helping, I'd like to continue it. So I want to get that fast feedback from the person who is trying a new thing, going out on a limb and say, hey, this isn't just me pushing you, this is us going together on this, and help me to help you.
I think that moment of asking for feedback too helps the person giving the feedback integrate their experience. I'm thinking of all those times when you do a recap at the end of a big complicated workshop and you're like, here are the things we learned. And I mean, you can hit coach trick. You can get your ratings to go way up if you do that right before you take your return on investment measurement, because they remember all of the things that were in fact valuable to them. So, but I think it's not about getting the ratings up. It's about letting people step back and see the big picture of what just happened. And I think that's an important step in learning and in building empathy and building trust.
Yeah, I keep getting stuck on what Claire mentioned about like offering to like do this with me sort of a thing, mainly because like there's so many times I'm like, I don't know how to empathize with you because I've not done this. I don't have your awful boss that's telling you to do these things. I don't have your environment. You know, now I'm in the world where I'm the consultant and I'm like, hey, I'm just here doing this kind of a thing. But I do always say, can I spend time with you? Like, I'm willing to walk with you wherever you need this to go for the purpose of understanding you.
So I had an example of a particular individual contributor task that I needed to do, which was to run a local Docker environment in order to test a story as an Agile tester. And I was having trouble getting this together. And so I invited one of the developers to join me in that activity. And after that pairing, since he had felt the frustration and the slow pace and the friction of trying to accomplish the task, he was better able to speak to that in our retrospective. Mm. And so he could bring his own experience of it to bear on the problem. And it wasn't just one person voicing it, it was now a shared experience. And I think that was more persuasive to the group.
That's really interesting. I keep thinking about crucial conversations as we're talking about this. And the idea of giving people time to unpack their stories, and that being an important part of helping. What, there's all this stuff about the shared pool of meaning and getting the information into the shared pool so that you can have that conversation. And I think that this sitting side by side that Claire's talking about, pairing on problems, is a very concrete way of getting people to unpack their stories with one another. And I like it a lot. It doesn't even require direct, intentional conversation about unpacking the stories. You're sharing the story together.
Those stories come out over time. Yeah. It just comes out in the wash of doing the thing together, right?
Yeah. I want to switch up gears and talk about failure as an employee, failure as a coach, failure as a outside hired hand, as an expert. Does it differ how you approach it, how you handle it?
Well, I just want to offer that I've been fired as a full-time employee and I've been fired as a contractor, so I don't know that matters.
Anyone here not been fired?
That sounds...
You've learned to fail both ways.
That sounds like you have experienced failure. Good work.
I just think it's different kinds of failure to start. I think it's maybe different sides of a similar coin, maybe not the exact same coin. So when I'm a full-time employee, I have more context going into a situation, and so I it's a more informed failure. Whereas a lot of times my failure as a consultant is, oh, I didn't know this or I did not realize this because I haven't been here years. I haven't worked with all these people before. So how can I see it through the lens of like a learning opportunity, as opposed to failure as a full-time employee, is more like, I don't know.
I wonder if one is safer than the other. There's the famous GE story of a new sort of senior VP level guy that comes in and in the first weeks makes a $5 million blunder and the following day goes into his boss's office with a letter of resignation. And the boss says, what the F are you doing? He's like, I just lost you $5 million. I'm leaving. The boss said, no, we just invested $5 million in your education. You're staying. Get back to your cube.
Sit down.
Right? So as an employee or, you know, a full-time person, failure is considered an option if you learn from it and you turn it into success somehow.
It reminds me.
I wonder if it's different as a contractor.
Maybe as a contractor. I can say as a consultant coach going in, I think as the safety goes down, it becomes much more powerful if you role model dealing with failure gracefully. And I don't know how many people have an opportunity to really do that, but I'm thinking of one particular client. And the more I would just own my small failures in the moment, the more people were comfortable with me. And I did it intentionally, and I did it every opportunity I had.
Being vocal about it, right? I do the same thing with, so I like what you said about small failures, and I do the same thing with my kids. I want my kids to see me like, hey, dad didn't intend to do this. When I said this wasn't cool. I didn't like the tone of voice that I used. Hey, I should have taken us to do this instead of this. Because I want them to understand, because those are, I think those kind of, in my mind, typify the small failures. Because the bigger failures I see as a consultant more like I'm learning this for the next client, you know what I mean? As opposed to the current one. Because the current client are more like, oh, I handled that conversation improperly because I didn't understand who that person was or what they've been working on the last 6 months or whatever, and that seems different.
But I'm not sure that that's a consultant problem. Sometimes as a full-time employee, there are things that I don't know because I'm not a subject matter expert that are totally obvious to other people in the room, right? And no one would think to say them because we just know. But if I'm new to the team or new to the industry or new to that particular space of the business, there are a lot of knowns that I just don't have. And if they're not explicitly communicated, it's an onboarding problem.
Yeah.
Plus compassion for somebody not to judge you and say, everybody knows that, Claire, come on. Opposed to putting themselves in your shoes.
Well, and but what I know of you, Claire, though, is that I think you have a fair amount of courage based on the stories you told me before about willing to speak up, because there's the failure that people won't speak up for. And what you're describing is like this onboarding issue. Hey, I had this issue. How do we make it so that the next people that come in behind me or the people that I mentor after that, how do we make their, so that's the failure, back to Andy's problem. Like, we just made an investment in your learning and also for your particular discipline overall. How can we make it so that other testers or other coders or other whatever, scrum masters, don't have that struggle? Like, I would think that is super valuable to the company.
So I have a really important burning question, which is, what the hell happened to the failure bow? I mean, I hear the old school agilists talk about it a lot, and Michelle Sliger, who I just co-facilitated with this session here, she does it all the time. And she does it in this really playful way. She's like, oops, I messed up. And everybody laughs.
I'm not sure what you're referring to.
Okay, so the failure bow is something that that agilists of 15, 20 years ago used to do all the time. So the idea is that on the team, when you make a mistake, you come into the team space and you make a glorious bow and you say, I messed this up. And everybody claps or laughs.
I've seen someone do this at the Agile conference. He was on staff. He said, I have failed, and just swept the arms out.
And it's such a wonderful gesture. And I'm like, where did this go? Because I think it's one way to constantly reinforce, hey, failure's okay. Everybody fails. And let's make a little game out of it.
We did the broken belts and blood.
It's kind of a cone of shame, right?
So, with tassels.
it's definitely funny to walk in and see some dude wearing a sombrero, in the thing, and it did eventually become the game of how the heck did we not wear the sombrero, and it is slightly shameful and it's kind of terrible, but it's what actually got this team over the hump of actually like paying attention to check-ins when things need to be merged. As we started to get to more trunk-based development, it was like, all right, well, my turn in the sombrero. And then, but they would stop and take a moment to debrief and actually talk about where they failed, why they broke the build, and how they could stop it for the next time. And then they honorably wore the sombrero until the next build failed, which could be the rest of that day.
Not just outing yourself, but continuing to make this a visible, systematic behavior of the team.
And acceptable and not shameful, right?
Right.
Your initial response was, it's the cone of shame, it's the dunce hat.
But does it need to be shame?
But contextually it is, we have found a problem, it's under the sombrero, and that person, we actually owe some thanks to. It's like the Etsy sweater, because we have found a vulnerability in our system, and we are committed to fixing it.
And we learned as a result.
And now we are stronger.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned the Etsy Three-Armed Sweater Award. Do you want to tell the story? Okay.
The what?
The Etsy Three-Armed Sweater Award. So this is a thing that they do. I believe, I may get the story wrong, so apologies if I do, but I believe that it started with a new developer who was hired on and then proceeded very shortly to take the entire site down.
Whoa.
And
it was a quote, this is in the DevOps handbook. Of some CSS that cleaned up some unused JavaScript that was being injected.
And so this poor kid, right, I imagine I imagine a guy who's like 18 years old and just like crumbling under the pressure of all this. This is my own story in my own head. Is met with thanks from senior executive leadership for exposing this vulnerability and helping the company learn that the vulnerability existed. And so this turned into an annual award that they give of a three-armed sweater, the third arm being, of course, the mistake. Yeah. And but they, as a culture, celebrate this kind of learning. I think that's thrilling.
It's not related to code, but we used to have, I worked at a company that had a Halloween costume contest, and they always had a magnificent failure award. Like, you know, you tried hard, but it just didn't quite do it. I will say that I've heard a TED talk about Google, that Google actually, when they're looking to promote people and look at bonuses and compensation reviews and such, they go, hey, what did they fail at and how did they handle it? They actually promote people that failed over people that didn't fail, because they saw that as you learned more. If you just did work and never messed up, what did you really learn?
Safe. You're not taking any risks. You're not innovating.
Right.
And you learn nothing.
Yeah.
You push no envelopes.
I guarantee you that kid that earned the first three-arm sweater, he probably became a fantastic coder after that. He was like, I will never do this again.
I imagine.
Does that feel like fear, though?
But it comes back to resilience.
How do you build resiliency?
You build resiliency by building a good community.
Yes. Right. So fear happens when you get shamed for it in a poor way. You get called out. I'm like, nobody ever do this stupid stuff again, right? Nobody be like this person. Instead.
Wait a minute, but you guys do that to me all the time. Don't be Gifford.
That is the Gifford exception.
There is like literally
that. Can I say, Erica?
I think he's a little hurt. I think there's maybe some trauma here.
So when Erica was like, I have a really important question to ask, she was looking right at Gifford, and I was almost like, yes, that is his real beard and not some fake hair that he just glued to his face, because that's what it looks like.
A merman.
It does not be
merman.
Nice.
Merman, you don't have to get personal.
Yeah.
Where's the code of conduct on that? I am feeling violated.
Hashtag tequila bar.
I think that how you handle that, talk to that person. So I can't remember which one of you said
we're
this.
The same person.
Well, no, you're different people with different ideas. But I remember one of you was talking about how we speak to each other in the aftermath of that really says a lot of, you know, can you wear that empathy hat and say, hey, let's talk about how we can make this better. You know, let's wear the Devo hat. Let's sit down. Let's have us a nosh, right? Let's walk through it. Let's have a mob programming session. Let's go backward through the builds, whatever. And then let's make it, you know, hey, we're glad that you found this problem here, right? Or you created this problem, so we'll never do it again, right?
So that's where DevOps talks about blameless postmortems. Or Agile has retrospectives where we're trying to say, let's talk about the facts of the situation and the sequence of events that occurred without making it about someone, but making it about the problem that we're trying to solve. And I had a situation on a team one time when the code got checked into master, and it should not have been able to be checked into master because we had a branching strategy that required you to create a feature branch and then make a pull request. However, the technical system didn't actually force you to do that. It was a procedural thing instead of a technical limit prevention. And that was a great opportunity to say, here is how we can make the system more robust and failure-proofing,
right.
where you design the system so it's easy to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And so we locked down committing to master so that we would be prevented from shooting ourselves in the foot again.
Make it easy to do the right thing. Yeah.
All right. So, what do you say we land this sucker? So, what did we learn here, gang? What are our big takeaways?
Make failure small.
I like that. Slice the failure up, as Claire said.
Celebrate it when there's learning.
Let's watch how we speak to each other when we're talking about failure. Let's make the right environment for that by making the work a learning experience as opposed to a shaming experience.
And pairing builds empathy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like what you brought in, Claire. Yeah.
And I think this calls back to me the prime directive of retrospective.
Yeah.
Where you did the best you could with what you knew at the time. And now that we're sharing this and being open about this failure, we'll have more information for the next time.
Yep. And if you make the mistake again, we're going to handle it the exact same way. And not go, well, it was okay to mess up once, but now that we've done it twice.
And I think that celebrating failure builds resiliency, which builds trust, which then in the end of the day potentially builds happiness with teams.
That, I was about to say, wow, I feel like I want to hug everybody now.
That was a great moment.
Wow. Whoa. That might have been the most kindest, softest landing you've ever provided to a podcast.
I'm guessing that's the most touching moment at the tequila bar tonight.
Yes. Yes. Very true. So,
so kind of just bringing us to a close, you know, I would love to thank you for having some random guests to kind of show up. Like, we don't always get this opportunity to just talk to actual practitioners in the field. So, you know, thank you to Erica and Claire. And, you know, with us wrapping up, we'd like to give you guys some time. If you're talking about anything, got any upcoming events, we'd like to give you some time to plug it, or if people want to reach out to you and connect on any of this in
I'm
the future,
a clarification
how
can
we kind of get a hold of you?
So I'm pretty easy to find. I'm often found live tweeting events. I have not been cut off by Twitter yet today, but it's not the end of the day yet, so I promise nothing. But you can find me on the internet.
The retweet machine, a clarification.
That's right. I'm here for you.
That's right.
So,
Here we go.
Social media and I are not great, but you can find me on Twitter, Erica_L_Lens. But really what I care about is that I'm co-chair of Mile High Agile, which is the Denver Regional Agile Conference.
And I'm very brokenhearted because
well, you know
I never get into
now.
It, and I've submitted last
No year. Promises. You got to submit something good, right?
Yeah, quit submitting bad things.
From your failure. But, you know, come visit us. We have an awesome conference. We have a good time. And we have lots of evil plans this year to make it extra awesome.
Yeah. And you know the rest of us. James is at Scrimando, and there's as Erica learned, there's two M's in Scrimando's, not one.
Oh, and there's a K in Erica.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Look spelling. To the show notes for proper
spelling. Yeah.
So it's been great. Here we are at Agile 2018 in San Diego. It's been a lot of fun. When is this going live?
Who knows?
Whenever James gets home, and
who the heck?
In the fall, I'll be enjoying some downtime. Less travel.
You can find me at Andy's house because I'm going there for some downtime because I need some.
All go there? Slumber party?
Let's all have a slumber party.
It's been a heck of a year. This summer has been nuts. At Andy Clef, at Chris Merman. Thank you everybody for listening. We'll catch you next time on the Uprising Pod.